You're listening to Green Left Radio, and for our program, for our second interview, we're very happy to have John Quiggin on our program. He is a professor of economics at the University of Queensland and is also the author of the book Zombie Economics and Economics in Two Lessons. And he is also runs a blog where he regularly kind of commentates on matters of economics. And so we have him here today to talk about, I guess, the federal budget. I guess maybe to start off, John, you've recently, I guess, published an article for The Conversation about the whole federal budget and its kind of failings on the climate, which we also republished for Green Left. What can you tell us, about, you know, you describe the recent federal budget as being, you know, almost a complete failure on climate action. I guess, what can you, I guess, to start off, what can you tell us about that?
Well, essentially, what's needed for global climate action is we start with an indicative commitment made in Paris to our first bid and how much we'll reduce emissions by 2030. That's supposed to be increased in ambition and then combined with a commitment consistent with the global goal agreed in 2015 of holding global warming below 2 degrees. What the government's done has been to give a fairly global indicative commitment for 2030, fiddly accounts so that we can meet that target notionally without actually reducing our emissions by claiming past emissions count against it, and then have no plan at all for the period beyond 2030. And that reflects the power of climate deniers in the government's backbench and indeed in the ministry. And so the budget attempts to again approach this issue in an entirely political and symbolic way. There's no serious attempt to meet Australia's energy needs or to put us on a path to decarbonisation. Rather, they go around and put out little jobs of money deal with particular political sensitivities. So there's a small amount of money for a coal-fired power station owned by a Liberal Party donor. Well, it's very bad policy, but it's such a tiny amount that it won't make much difference in the long run. There's another $50 million for carbon capture and storage research. We've already spent close to $500 million on that here and much more overseas with no real success. So again, this is a purely symbolic measure that allows them then to make up a future in which carbon capture and storage works. The big political need is to get the dinosaurs on the government backbench away from coal, which is clearly a political loser, while not giving any ground to the Greens. And therefore, on that basis, rather than on any coherent analysis, they've chosen to focus on gas, and that's been part of the policy for some time.
Yeah. And I guess one of the arguments I guess you've sort of raised, I guess, in this article, and you probably allude to this in your kind of early comments, but I guess I want to kind of get a bit more kind of a specific sort of analysis. You kind of raise this issue around technology and investment, and I guess you make this kind of claim that the Morrison government is sort of opting for this approach to climate action by sort of picking and choosing sort of preferred technologies for investment. And I guess from an economic kind of perspective, what do you think is, I guess, the shortcomings, I guess, of this approach from the Morrison government?
Well, of course, this has been long-standing in the LNP, and quite odd. The standard market economic prescription would be have a carbon price. That could be either a carbon tax or tradable emission permits. That would mean that the emissions reductions could be made in the cheapest possible way. The government has been so resistant to that, so resistant to many different variants, always able to sniff out the heresy of some kind of market instrument, that probably the time has passed. So I think there's a case that we do need to pick winners. The problem is simply the government isn't doing it in a coherent fashion that says let's actually look at the technologies and see what needs to be done. If it did that, it would be going hard into solar plus batteries. It isn't even putting forward big amounts of money for the technologies it's favoured. Rather, it's symbolically picking winners. It's saying these are the technologies we like, which is carbon capture and storage, pumped hydro in the snowy, some transmission, which is good. These are the ones we don't like, which is solar PV and wind. We won't give them any more money. So it really is, as I say, a budget driven entirely by domestic politics, the combination of the culture war against the environmentalists and the belief that they need to keep exports of coal going, which is a secondary part of the story. But that is their policy framework.
Well, thanks. Thanks for that, John. I guess the next kind of question, you sort of make some comparisons in your article around around how this kind of compares kind of internationally. And I guess I want to kind of hear a bit more of elaboration in terms of the government's kind of approach to climate action with its federal budget. How does it kind of compare internationally to some other countries?
Sure. Well, I mean, we can start with the Europeans who have actually taken this seriously, and they're well on the way to phasing out coal, even though they had a huge amount of it. They've got essentially none left by 2030, a serious commitment to decarbonisation by 2050. The same with a bunch of other developed country jurisdictions like Canada. Then you have, among the developed countries, the current laggards are the US, Japan and Australia. The US still making progress because state level jurisdictions are doing a lot to reduce emissions. That's happened to some extent here. And assuming we get the right outcome in a few weeks' time, Biden is committed to a climate plan which, while maybe not adequate, is certainly comparable to what's being done in Europe. China has been holding off. It's gone back and forward on this, but recently announced a commitment to decarbonisation by 2060. Politically, I think they've seen the writing on the wall that the strategy they had been pursuing, which involved a pivot back to coal, was going to be very costly to them. Biden's promise to introduce border adjustments, that is taxes on imports generated from China because they're cheating on coal. So Japan has finally moved away. They've said they're going to close down all of their old and inefficient power stations by 2030. Their definition of old and inefficient covers every single coal-fired power station in Australia. So really, we're left right at the back of the pack with countries like Saudi Arabia, which have nowhere to go other than fossil fuels.
Well, going into more kind of general direction into some of the other kind of work you've kind of written, you wrote, I guess, another kind of article for the Independent Australia, kind of responding to the federal budget, giving a more kind of general critique of the budget, not just focusing, I guess, on climate action. You wrote in the article that it's, I guess, an example of the federal government, the Liberal government, coalition government in this case, returning to the lazy kind of thinking of the past, especially compared to what they were able to kind of do in March and April earlier this year during the pandemic. I guess, what are your kind of comments sort of elaborating on that sort of argument?
Well, in the article, I think I make the point, supposing you imagine a year totally unlike the last year, one in which there weren't any bushfires, there was no pandemic, things just rolled along the budget surplus that Frydenberg had promised in 2019 happened. And then say, well, in what way would the budget measures in this budget be different from the budget? What kind of difference would there be in the budget Frydenberg would have introduced in those circumstances compared to what we actually saw? And the answer, in my view, is none at all. They probably would have brought forward the second stage tax cuts if they were flush with money. They certainly would have splashed out money on infrastructure because that's what governments like doing. We would have seen stringency for the arts, ABC, all the sectors the government doesn't like. We probably wouldn't have seen anything good done for unemployed workers. So in other words, after having acted boldly back in March and April, they're back to doing exactly what they would do, except no longer worrying about debt and deficits, just saying we're going to just go ahead and do exactly the things we were going to, even though we've spent another couple of $100 billion dealing with the pandemic.
To change the topic, thanks for that answer. I guess what I've read that on your blog that I guess you're in the process, I guess, of writing a book on the economic consequences of the pandemic. And I guess I want to hear kind of your comments. In what way is the federal government actually responding to the economic kind of impacts of the pandemic? And where do you think, I guess, it's failing, or maybe, I guess, even where is it trying to address some of the economic impacts of the pandemic?
Well, as I say, it did a good job addressing the immediate impacts of the pandemic, but as I've indicated, it's just in the current budget, just acting as if it had never happened. There's no recognition either of the change now in our global situation as a result of the pandemic, or of the things which were happening anyway and have been made clearer as a result of the pandemic. So it's clear from the pandemic that the real problems in our economy lie in various parts of the service sector, that areas like aged care are under-addressed. That's a federal government responsibility. that low-paid service workers have all sorts of problems. Of course, the pandemic has also created huge problems for the tourism hospitality sectors. But none of that appears anywhere in the budget. Same with childcare. Instead, we get shovel-ready infrastructure projects so that the Prime Minister can pose in a high-vis vest and a hard hat, just like as if nothing at all had changed. So there's no real recognition of anything to do with how the pandemic's affected us, or indeed how the society itself has changed over the past 20 years. I suppose I should add one point of credit, you know, announced before the budget is the fixing the NBN, undoing the disastrous mixed mode NBN that Malcolm Turnbull gave us, and actually trying to get that proper. So that, although outside the budget, was an example of responding to the needs we've revealed. But in other areas, childcare and so forth, the idea that we can and should organise ourselves differently in the light of the pandemic simply doesn't seem to have sunk into the government at all.
Okay. Now, of course, we've had a bit of a discussion, I guess, on what's wrong, I guess, with the federal budget and your kind of critiques of it. I guess I want to kind of hear you from your perspective, I guess, what would an alternative kind of federal budget, I guess, that even prioritises climate action, for example, or even just prioritises kind of the need of kind of ordinary kind of people? What do you think, I guess, that would look like, I guess, in terms of policy, especially in comparison to where this federal government budget has failed?
Well, certainly, obviously, investing in climate action and social housing, things that have been revealed to be necessary, as opposed to more big road projects of the kind that we've been having for the last however many decades on the investment side. In terms of, in terms of addressing people's needs, we had the opportunity with JobKeeper So High to really make a radical change in our system of income support, to return the unemployment benefit, whatever it's called, permanently at the level of the old age pension, which is where it was until the 1990s, add other benefits in and expand eligibility so that we can deal with an economy where a very large portion of the time there aren't suitable jobs available for lots of people. That would have been part of, I think, we haven't really adapted our thinking to the low interest rate environment, which I think is permanent, which suggests that government investment should be substantially larger in general, and that we should be investing in particular more in people, which are the obviously glaring areas, early childhood, which hasn't been is a major area of shortfall, and fixing the problems of the post-school education sector, particularly the universities that have been created by the loss of the international student market. There's a huge need, I think, for something for sensible intervention there, instead of what we got was a package. Even described as ideological is too generous. A package that's driven by ill-informed prejudice about what kind of degrees the government likes and what kind it doesn't like. And that's unfortunately typical of this government's approach. Although obviously it's a government of and for the rich, it's also driven by all these cultural crotchets about who has the right kind of car, lives in the right kind of suburb, does the right kind of job. A whole range of these things which drive its policy in all sorts of ways.
All right. Well, thanks for that. We might kind of conclude, I guess, this interview. You've made some very interesting kind of comments. I guess, do you have any, I guess, final comments, I guess, you'd like to make, maybe summing up what we've sort of spoken about?
Well, I think it's now very likely that the Trump administration will be decisively defeated in the next election. I think the effect of that in Australia was substantial. That of all the developed country governments, this one has tied its fate most closely to Trump. I suspect people have noticed, I think, the government's climate denial policy will become much less tenable with a Biden administration, which already has a policy of border adjustments. And in general, the whole calculations driving this culture war stuff, if Trump is decisively rejected in the US, will start to collapse. So I expect to see quite a major change arising in light of that outcome, assuming, of course, it happens.